Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with composer Mason Bates and conductor Ragnar Bolin about their new collaboration with Capella SF, a CD titled Mass Transmission, choral works by Mason Bates. Writer and performer Paul Sussman stops by to share details about his solo show, The Wrong Kind of Pessimism, currently at The Marsh in San Francisco through May 18th. In the show, Paul explores human progress over the last few millennia, from Neanderthal times to the present post-Trump, shall we say, postmodern Neanderthal times. In the process, he takes on the big questions of progress, faith, and where it all ends. Plus, returning to KLW is internationally known Kathak dancer Farah Yasmin Sheikh, will be making her first solo appearance in the Bay Area in 5 years this Saturday in San Jose. She'll be joined by violinist Raginder Singh Momi, and you'll share some of his music in the conversation. Stay with us. Evocative music to start Open Air this week as Nurani Dance presents Nazakat or Ta'at, translated as A Delicate Power, this Saturday afternoon at the Mexican Heritage Museum in San Jose. Nurani Dance was founded by Kathak artist Farah Yasmin Sheikh. Farah is renowned as a performer, choreographer, and instructor, and her evocative storytelling, technical precision, delicacy and grace are trademarks of her incredible style. And her unique artistic voice includes topics of historical, social, and political relevance while maintaining the classical elements of Kathak. She was last seen with us on Open Air to talk about The Parting, a vivid and large ensemble piece depicting the 1947 partition of India into three countries by the British, that she choreographed as well as starred in during its dual run in San Jose and San Francisco in early 2018. Welcome back to our Open Airwaves, Farah.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back.
Happy to have you. And she's joined by Raginder Singh Momi, a violinist and composer from here in the San Francisco Bay Area, who will be among the musicians participating. Raginder implements improvisation, rhythmic patterns, and the sounds of Indian classical music on a modified five-string violin, which we'll talk about. He's deeply embedded into the tradition of Hindustani music, but also immersed in contemporary music, where he intermingles the sounds of Indian classical violin and hip-hop. He's performed all over the world in venues ranging from the White House to the Wembley Arena. A very kind welcome to you, Raginder. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Farah, let's start with a little review of the different types of classical Indian dance and what distinguishes Kathak from others.
Absolutely. So Kathak is one of 8 classical forms of dance, and they originate from different regions of the country. Kathak specifically comes from North India, and it is said to be one of the only, if not the only, that has the influence most definitely of the Hindu belief system, where through our storytelling mechanism, we tell the stories of the Hindu epics, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana. And as the Mughals came into India, they brought with them their very rich culture as well. And Kathak happened to be the form that was preserved, practiced, passed on in the Mughal courts. And so the music and dance of essentially the Persians of that time that influenced Kathak and even the classical music that accompanied Kathak. We saw a lot of evolution in stylization, in the way that the music and dance sort of formed this really lovely relationship. And so we celebrate in modern day multiple aspects of these influences in Kathak. And again, all forms of the classical dances have a storytelling component, and the movement rhetoric is what changes and the way we use our expression and bodies to tell those stories.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of storytelling, that's very much a part of this Saturday's performance, as it will start with a series of vignettes, some of which are invocational, offering gratitude and respect to the divine, as well as short songs sourced from the writings of some of India's and Pakistan's greatest poets. Tell us a couple of the stories that you chose to involve in this coming Saturday's performance.
Absolutely. So what Saturday is going to be is what we generically refer to as a traditional Kathak solo. So these vignettes are meant to highlight the different components and aspects of the art form. Some sections will be much more of an emphasis on the pure rhythms and the improvisation, the conversations that the dancer, myself, has with the musicians through our respective mediums. But yes, the storytelling will be shown in various ways, sometimes short components, songs, but the main highlight story for this weekend is one that we're premiering, and in Kathak, one dancer, myself, I have to portray all of the characters. So the music similarly has to portray all these different characters. The story we've chosen for this weekend is one that's based from a 18th century poet by the great poet Waris Shah, and it's by the name of Hir, and it's the story is Hir Ranja. And this is something actually Raginder, I had talked to him first about doing because she shared with me some of the music that is inspired by this poem. And this has evolved into essentially, it's very, probably the closest comparison I can make for this story is to that of Romeo and Juliet, where it's a tragic love story. But more than that, it goes deep into sort of uncovering the layers of why these two individuals were kept apart. Some of it was religious divide, socioeconomic stratification in many ways. And it really, the tragedy of it all, and I think the reason I find it to be so poignant, is that ongoing lesson of what happens when we keep people apart. And that is a really, I think, something that we need to keep discussing, keep, you know, very much like the stories that we told around partition.
Right, right.
What happens? So these themes, it's about uncovering human emotion at its weakest place, as well as celebrating it at its strongest.
Mm, very nice. Raginder, you, I understand that it was a basketball and hip-hop that were your conduit into American culture.
Yes, yes. So I moved to America in 2001. I was an 8-year-old kid. My only introduction to America prior to that was Michael Jackson. And I grew up in the 90s in Bangkok. And the only introduction to America I had was Michael Jackson, MTV, and once I moved to America, the first thing that grasped me immediately, one was hip-hop music and one was basketball. And at that time, there was the Northern California, Southern California rivalry between the Kings and the Lakers. So I stuck with the Northern California roots and, you know, stuck with the Kings, but then eventually became a Warriors fan.
So growing up in Bangkok.
Yes, yes. And my basically, my parents are both musicians, and my dad, once he got his music degree in sitar, he got a job offer to teach Indian music in Bangkok. So he taught music in Bangkok for 15 years. I was born there. My sister was born there. I lived there for 8 years, and then moved to America as a young kid.
So they were maintaining as performers Indian classical music in Bangkok?
Yes, more as teachers, mm-hmm. But they definitely performed as well.
And I understand your dad's going to be participating this coming Saturday.
Actually, unfortunately, Dalbirji, due to a repetitive stress injury from teaching, and because he's so committed to that line of work, he's unable to join us. But we are excited that we have, of course, Raginder, his sister. You know, they come from a family of musicians. So mm-hmm. His sister, Dagini, will be on harmonium. She's also even part of the opening dance piece as a student of Nurani dance. And also Raginder's cousin, Surtal, is going to be joining us on vocals.
Mm-hmm. Raginder, so growing up in this musical family, was it just a natural thing for you? Were you forced to learn violin as a kid, or did you want to naturally be a part of it all?
my journey was interesting in a way because I started, before I can even remember what my first memory of music was, I started learning how to sing first. Then I learned tabla. And then I got to a point, once I moved to America, around fifth grade, the elementary school took you to an assembly and they're like, all right, here's the instruments you want to play. I initially wanted to play the trumpet, but my parents were like, try out the violin and see what happens. So they made the right decision in hindsight.
So
you could kind of say I was forced into it, but I think as I started learning, I really grasped onto the violin and just really started to fall in love with the instrument.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned early on that this was an adapted violin for five strings.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about it.
So my violin teacher, she's actually the first woman in India to actually play the Indian classical violin. And she has had many students throughout her career, and one of her students was an instrument maker. And he came from a lineage of instrument makers as well. And she had an idea to add an extra lower string on the violin, because usually there's four strings. And she wanted to add the lower string just so there can be more of an lower an octave range. And also there's sympathetic strings on the bottom, so it has that resonance like how a sitar would have as well.
Mm. Can we hear just an example of what that... We'll have a larger example a little later on, but since we're talking about it now, just show us the different strings and how they operate.
So the fifth string, it's a C string, so this is what you would hear on a viola, but this is added on the violin.
And you hear the sympathetic vibration there, yeah.
Yeah, so say... This is tuned to the fifth of the scale.
And that's underneath the initial four strings.
Yeah, so if I play this note, this same exact string would resonate with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Mm. We'll hear a little bit more of that shortly. Back to Farah, I understand that in addition to the musicians you mentioned, including Raginder's siblings, the show will open with some young musicians and dancers. Tell us about that.
That is correct. So... this is the first time that students of Nirani Dance will be doing a public presentation in this way. So we have 40 students, dancers, on stage for our first piece. And I had this idea, unfortunately, Raginder and another one of our musicians, Nilan, who's on tabla with us, they were receptive to it. So essentially, we came up with the idea to have next generation musicians accompany next generation dancers. So we have four young tabla players, students of Nilan and or his father, Pandit Swapan Chaudhary. We have a student of Raginder, who Sukamrit is the young boy's name, and he happened to also train with Raginder's guru. And then we have a young vocalist, two young vocalists. So, yes, we have a wonderful ensemble of these younger up-and-coming artists, if they should so choose to focus and stay disciplined as their teachers are attempting to continue on that path themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like quite an afternoon, and following it all will be a wonderful gala. You can learn more about that at Nirani Dance. That's NORANIDance.com. Again, the performances will be at the Mexican Heritage Center in San Jose, starting at 5:30,
correct,
I believe.
Yes.
Right. NuriDance.com for more information. Raginder, I'm hoping that you could give us some music to go out with this segment.
Sure.
Could you tell us what you'd like to play?
I will be playing a rag called Rag Yaman, which is based on the Lydian mode in Western classical music. And this rag is played to invoke joy. So I hope that's how we go out.
Raginder Singh Momi. Thank you so much for sharing. That's Raginder Singh Momi, among the musicians that are going to be participating in Nazak Ahat Or Tat, a delicate power this Saturday afternoon at the Mexican Heritage Museum in San Jose. Farah Yasmin Sheikh, thank you as well for coming in today.
Thank you.
I wish you a wonderful performance, and I'm sure we'll be seeing you again.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, you'll hear about Paul Sussman's one-man show at the Marsh in San Francisco, dealing with Neanderthals, old and recent. But next, I was actually hoping my next guests, both returnees and great musical friends, would have lugged their Grammy Awards with them. We're kind of short on paperweights here at San Francisco's KLW. Plus, we've got a great new display area we could have put them in. So if you want to lend them out, boys, by all means, we'll watch them for a while. Conductor Ragnar Bolin, director of the San Francisco Symphony Chorus, for which he won the Grammy for choral performance in the symphony's 2010 recording of Mahler 8 with Michael Tilson Thomas, is also conductor of Capella SF, a small chamber choir that has been under his direction since its founding in 2013. Recently highlighted was his performances with current composer in residence David Conte here on Open Air. And welcome back to you, Ragnar.
Thank you.
Named Musical America as the 2018 Composer of the Year, as well as the most performed composer of his generation, Grammy-winning composer Mason Bates is widely renowned for his pioneering practice of creating music for conventional performing forces enhanced by electronic sounds. His recent opera, The Revolution of Steve Jobs, was singled out as one of the most popular productions in the history of San Francisco opera. And the winner of the aforementioned Grammy is recorded by Seattle Opera and will have its hometown debut at San Francisco Opera this fall. In addition to being composer in residence at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, he continues his work as DJ, curator, pioneer. I'm very pleased to call him a dear friend as well. Mason, welcome back to Open Air.
Great to be back here, David.
And thanks for taking the time. The recent collaboration between you two, I hope, will result in another Grammy, because it sounds so beautiful. The just-released CD, Mass Transmission, Choral Works by Mason Bates, includes two main works, the title track, a commission by the San Francisco Symphony for their 2012 Mavericks Festival, and Sirens, a six-movement work commissioned by Chanticleer back in 2019. A further bonus track is also included, which we'll get to a little bit later. So whose idea was it for this CD?
I guess it was my
Ragnar.
Idea. I heard the premiere by Chanticleer 2009 and was just blown away. So I was just waiting to get an opportunity to lay my hands on this masterpiece.
Mm-hmm. And Mason, you're all in, I imagine.
You know, I wrote this piece, Mass Transmission, very much in consultation with Ragnar.
Oh.
I remember running into Ragnar backstage at the San Francisco Symphony around the time that I was premiering the first piece I wrote for the orchestra called The B-Sides. And I had mentioned this concept to Ragnar about a piece that would deal with early communication technology. And so it's taken 10 years or 8 years for us to bring this into recorded life. Mm-hmm. But Ragnar's always been a key element in that project.
We'll talk about Mass Transmission to go out with, but let's start with the opening work on the CD, Sirens. Amazing sounds you get, including a 12-part choral arrangement of the first movement. Tell us, first of all, Sirens uses a variety of texts. Interesting that you also call Jesus a siren from the book of Matthew, which makes sense. As how else could you describe someone who inspired fishermen to leave their profession and become fishers of men by following Jesus Christ? But tell us about how you chose the text, and then we can talk about setting them.
You know, actually, the text, The Calling of the First Disciples, was the first text that I found, and at that time I didn't know that the sirens would be the title of the cycle. I actually went back to an old mentor of mine in Virginia, where I grew up, who named Ron Smith, is a poet and an English teacher. And I said, you know, I really want to set this incredibly beautiful and kind of eerie text from the Bible when Jesus says, put down your nets and I'll teach you to be fishers of men. I said, that's just, it's something that I feel like is it's kind of a revolutionary thing to say to people. Where could I go with that? And Ron said to me, it sounds like a siren, like siren imagery, because you're next to the water. There's this charisma in this kind of beauty that's intertwined with danger. And I thought, well, maybe this text is actually the kind of dramatic climax of a piece that would go through different kinds of siren Texan mythology. And what I thought at the time was that there would be lots of different poems in the English language about sirens. It turns out there are not as many as I thought, but there are many from different cultures. There's German, there's Italian, there's even something from Quechua. So what became Sirens was this kind of intersection of beauty and danger.
The movement we talked about from the Book of Matthew is set in English, but I've got a variety of languages, including, you mentioned, Quechuan. Is it Greek as well for the opening, Homer? I'm curious how you go about setting a language that you're not necessarily fluent in, unless we know something, not if we don't know something about you, Mason.
Yeah, I don't speak six different languages, including one that's indigenous to Peru. It's a great question, though, and I'd love to hear also Ragnar talk about how you go about singing that. Basically, for me, I met with a Greek speaker at UC Berkeley, and I spoke with a woman who speaks Quechua at UC Davis. I went through it. I mean, I had studied German and Italian enough to understand how to set it. What's fascinating, though, as a composer is that these different languages really bring out different musics from a composer. The sounds that these languages inhabit are very much like percussive sounds, and the music needs to respond to them. I mean, German is a very different sounding language than Italian. And so that was a fascinating kind of byproduct of all of these different languages. And Joe Jennings, the kind of mentor, kind of visionary head of Chanticleer 10 years ago, said use those sounds as part of your world. So yeah, then I would hand it off to, you know, somebody like Ragnar, a real master of, I mean, all chorus masters have to deal with different languages, but Ragnar himself, a polyglot, is somebody who can uniquely understand how to bring that to life. And so I'm kind of curious how your singers and you approach something that's in Greek, Quechuan, German, French, English.
And safe to say, this is probably the first Quechuan you've said to me. I had to teach.
It is. So obviously the German and the Italian didn't pose any problems because we sing quite often in those languages, and English, of course. But for the Greek, we had to consult a Greek-speaking person, both when I did it here with Capella SF and likewise in Stockholm when I did it with a Swedish radio choir recently, last November. And for the Quechua, same thing, that we needed to consult an expert and just trust that we were on the right track. So it's not easy, but, you know, as a choir master, you do your research as much as you can, consulting native speakers of the language, and then you also trust the composer that it's set the right way, so the emphases are on the right places, and then you go with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear a little bit from that first movement of From the Odyssey, set in Greek, right? Am I correct? Set in Greek. This is from the new CD that's by Ragnar Bolin's group Capella SF, the choral works by Mason Bates, From Sirens, and then more with these gentlemen.
Thank you.
Just a brief excerpt from the first movement of Sirens, that from the Odyssey, Book 12 of Homer, set in Greek by Mason Bates and sung incredibly by Capella SF. Further movements of Sirens include settings of Heinrich Heine, De Lorelei, some native Quechuan, as well as the Book of Matthew, and a more Homer to round things out in the sixth movement. Mason, there's an absolutely beautiful movement set by a 16th century poet, is that correct?
It's an Italian sonnet, and unlike many of the siren texts from history, like the one you just heard, which have this kind of hypnotic pull of beauty that is actually kind of ends in death, this sonnet is about this kind of celestial sirens that sit atop the stars. And so Stella, both in the text and in the music, creates these little constellations of sounds.
From Sirens, Stelle Vostre... Oh, I'm not going to murder this. Maybe you can help me out, Ragnar.
Oh, I need to pull it. Vostre merce le celse sfere.
From Sirens by Mason Bates. Extraordinary sounds of Capella SF singing the third movement, Stelle, from Mason Bates' work Sirens, on a new CD called Mass Transmission, the second major work and the title track of the CD that's just released. Congratulations to you both on this amazing sounding endeavor. Boy, let's move on to Mass Transmission. Now, Mason, what on earth got you interested in the first radio transmissions from Holland to Java, Indonesia, the subject of Mass Transmission?
It's kind of like early Skype, to be honest with you. It's the first long-range radio transmissions from the 1920s that were between Holland and its colony in Java, which is sort of like us talking to the moon or something. I sought that out because I wanted to have a musical collision of like something that had an indigenous sound world, and this kind of technological meat grinder. So I was like literally looking up things like Radio Village, and I thought maybe there's something in Africa. It's not like I stumbled on that just randomly. I really was searching out the subject matter. Then what popped up is, if you ever see this CD, you'll see on the cover there's this unbelievable architecture. It's this thing popped up on the internet, and it's at Radio Kuchvik, which is this kind of island in Holland, where there's this huge radio station. And I read that there's a transcript from a mother who had been communicating with her daughter over there, and kind of like a memoir about it. And of course, it was in Dutch. So I had to find, that's right, somebody that spoke Dutch at UC Berkeley. Thank God for UC Berkeley. And the first line was, "The miracle lies in my memory like a dream." And so I was like, wow, that's really poetic.
Wow, yeah.
So I went about setting it. And I, on the outer movements, it's the perspective of the mother. And the inner movement, it's a memoir from a woman who did this very thing. She lived in Java as a child and wrote about the kind of sights and smells. So, I mean, there's a lot of musical things about that that I find interesting. But basically, you know, when I wrote this, I had, you know, a new baby, and I was Skyping all the time with my wife, Jamie, and kind of like always aware that this technology that we speak through brings us together, but it also just kind of reminds us how far apart we are, because it's just like so scratchy and weird. And it was astounding to find something from 100 years ago that so resonated. It was really cool to bring this to life with Ragnar and this incredible group, Capella SF. You know, when you listen to what you just heard, Sirens, it's kind of like watching an incredible principal ballerina. You know, it looks so easy. They make it sound so easy. It's really hard.
And Mason, thanks for setting it in English, not in Dutch.
So, they've done an incredible job across the board. And the singing style in this piece is quite different, different challenges. There's an organ involved, there's electronics. So,
tell us about the particular excerpt that we've queued up for you.
Well, this is from the middle of the piece when we're hearing from the daughter who's in Java. And so I actually went to UC Berkeley and worked with this incredible Indonesian drummer named Midianto, who might be familiar to some people here. And I recorded him playing and got some gamelan sounds. And so you'll hear the chorus talking about living in the jungle. And just towards the end of it, we then go and hear this dialogue between mother and daughter.
This love is so unreal, like a cloud on my soul.
from Mass Transmission, documenting in music an incredible soundscape, some of the first radio transmissions from Holland to Java, Indonesia, then composed by my guest, Mason Bates, incorporating some of the electronic sounds that are a trademark of his incredible work. Wonderful sounds, Mason. So thank you so much for that.
Thanks.
And the CD is from Capella SF under the magnificent direction of Ragnar Bolin. Again, just beautiful work. Now, Mason, your music is being performed around the world, let's face it, we could say almost every week, by some orchestra, chamber group. How do you choose which performances to attend, or might you stop by unexpectedly on one of the more low-profile ensembles, say the East Texas Youth Orchestra, who's doing Mothership this Sunday, or maybe the NYC Queer Urban Orchestra doing the same piece in June?
I didn't know that they were doing that. That's awesome. Well, you know, it's about kind of making sure you have enough time to compose. I absolutely love that these different orchestras, especially, you know, orchestras at a regional level and universities, have been able to do this music, because it brings new music to places that don't often have it. And also, you know, for the rest of my life, I'll have people coming up and say, oh, I played Mothership when I was, you know, at East Texas University.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I love to do it as much as I can. I really am a firm believer in, you know, community music making. It's not something you read about in the New York Times or the Washington Post, because those writers don't often leave those cities. But that's what is strong about our country's music making, is all these great ensembles that are happening, you know, every week, performances of more adventurous rep than we might even realize.
Nice. And obviously, you must be, as we all are, looking forward to the San Francisco Opera's production of The Revolution of Steve Jobs this fall. What else is on your performing calendar that you're looking forward to, or perhaps on your palette of new works?
Well, I'm working on a piece for several different orchestras called World's Greatest Synth, The Making of the Orchestra. It's a kind of a passion project, in that I have been trying to push this into existence for a couple of years. It's a piece for animated film and orchestra, just like when you go to see film concerts. But it's like a 20-minute piece that kind of flies inside instruments, and it's made in collaboration with Gary Rydstrom of Lucasfilm and Jim Capobianco, an amazing animator.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that's happening at San Francisco Symphony next May, I believe.
Uh-huh. Great. Also your work with Mercury Soul just this past Sunday at the DNA Lounge here in San Francisco. Time management must be the challenge for you right now. Obviously, any forthcoming commissions must take priority, but how do you decide what time to allocate to these many and varied compartments of the brain trust of Mason Bates?
I mean, 9 to 5, basically. And I mean, I try to work every hour of that 9 to 5. Mercury Soul, we just had an amazing show, and we have one coming up on June 14th at Monarch. It's a great collision of classical music and electronics. And when is y'all's next concert, by the way?
The symphony or Capella?
The Capella.
Capella is in November, an old French program.
Oh, man. Well, people should definitely check out everything these guys do. Because
we'll have them back, no doubt.
Yeah, it's really special to hear an a cappella group that great.
Among other institutions, you both are on the faculty of the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. How are you finding this new generation of composers, conductors, choral singers that have an unprecedented amount of resources before them as they train their young musical minds, not to mention just as many distractions? Maybe Ragnar can handle that one first.
Well, I lead the conservatory chorus together with Eric Choate, and it's a mixed bag, if I may say, of students and singers. Some of them are voice majors and really experienced, and some are pianists, composers, with very little experience in singing. So, and a few of them, when I start up in the fall, have not sung at all, and yet we manage to do quite often quite challenging repertoire. And I'm assuming that it really helps them to have access to online, to go to YouTube and check out the repertoire that we're doing.
And how about you, on the composing front, how are you guiding the hand of some of these young composers?
Well, it's about understanding the history of these ensembles and the repertoire that we have and how you can bring new things to it. You really can't do one without the other. And so for me, adding electronics to my world didn't happen. You know, probably for 7 or 8 years after I'd written for orchestra. And I try to encourage people to go to live music as much as they can. You know, you get great ideas in those settings, and also you don't have the ability to fast forward or skip around like we do when we're listening to music at home. So for me, it's kind of like going to a sacred space.
Mm-hmm. Well, this wonderful CD that's available now, Mass Transmission, Choral Works by Mason Bates, performed by Capella SF, Ragnar Bolin, artistic director, also has a bonus track. We have Sirens, we have Mass Transmission, and then Rag of Ragnar. Tell us about this this compilation. It's kind of a mix-up of yours.
Well, this was inspired by all these cool sounds that we put together for the CD. I had said maybe I could take some of the stems, some of like just the pure recordings of close-up of voices and make something of it. And actually mentioning time management and whatnot, as I started to do this, I realized, God, this is hard, even just to make a three-minute thing, to make it cool. And thankfully, the Capella SF crew, you know, Cordy and Ragnar, were like, no, you can't say no at this point. You got to finish it. And so I really pushed myself to create this kind of remix of some of the sounds on Mass Transmission.
Rag of Ragnar, but composed by Mason Bates. Thanks so much for coming in, Mason. Ragnar?
Thank you very much.
Great. Great to be here.
From Mason Bates to Richard Strauss, and taking a cue from Stanley Kubrick, who incorporated this iconic music of Strauss also sprach Zarathustra into the opening of his 2001 A Space Odyssey. I thought this was music appropriate to introduce my next guest, Paul Sussman, whose solo show at the Marsh, Wrong Kind of Pessimism, takes grand steps similar to the great Stanley Kubrick. And though Kubrick's music and Kubrick's film begins with hominids, or great apes, and ended in the depths of space, Paul posits that the Neanderthals should have won the evolution race over Homo sapiens and continues to ponder evolution in modern times. It is evolution, after all, and we're all a part of it. Using a good dose of humor, Paul takes on the big questions of progress, faith, and where it all ends in The Wrong Kind of Pessimism, part of the Marsh Discovery Series at the Marsh San Francisco, Saturdays at 5 p.m. through the 18th of May. Paul Sussman has written and performed a series of solo pieces through the eyes of road ragers, insects, Anabaptists, cannibals, and others who persist in the search for meaning amidst the puzzling evidence. He developed his approach to melodrama and farce through years of work in financial management with Bay Area nonprofit organizations. This is his first hour-length show. A pleasure to welcome you to our studios, Paul, for what I think will be a fascinating conversation.
Thank you, David. Great to be here.
Now, The Wrong Kind of Pessimism begs the question, is there a right kind of pessimism?
Well, there is. I have some things to say about the wrong kind of pessimism in the show, but I don't spell out the right kind of pessimism.
All right. Okay. You consider the opposite of pessimism, though, to be optimism, but hold that optimism is not the sole property of faith and religion, or that faith is not the sole property of religion.
Yeah, I think faith has gotten a bad name among us pessimists. Somehow it's the sort of thing that, I think it was Nietzsche who said, people who are afraid to see the world as it is, that's who faith is for. You look at the evidence out there. You know, I started working on this show before the election in 2016. I think there's a lot of signs that things may not be heading in the right direction. And you have to keep yourself going. You have to keep yourself out there. You have to work for a better world. And that requires some kind of faith in something.
Indeed. Now, you did considerable research on Neanderthals as part of the process of creating this work. What did you learn?
Well, I learned that I am 1.6% Neanderthal. We'll get to that. So I have personal stake in the history of the Neanderthals. The piece really began with a look at what I call the first gentrification. And that was that Neanderthals were on a kind of parallel track with Homo sapiens ourselves. And they'd been living and thriving up and down in Europe and Asia for 300,000 years. Homo sapiens crossed the water out of Africa, and in a couple of thousand years, the Neanderthals were gone. Hard to think that was a coincidence.
I understand that we all have a little bit of Neanderthal still in our DNA.
We do. Those that are descended from anyone who crossed out of Africa has got that Neanderthal blood in them, and the better for it.
Now, I also understand that a book you found in your father's bookcase plays a part in the show. Tell us about that
book. It does. You know, some people will pull out a locket that their great-great-great-grandmother had, or a letter from the first immigrant from Sweden or something. I had a book that I found in my father's library after he died almost 20 years ago that had been my book. I recognized it. I'd bought it in Berkeley in my 20s off of a remainder table. And it was called The History of Progress, History of the Idea of Progress. And it was filled with Post-it notes. He found something fascinating in there. I didn't have time to really take a look. You know, we were cleaning out his apartment and we were arranging for things. I threw it in my bag and it sat there back in my house until I started reflecting again on this question of, is there even such a thing as progress, especially in later years? And I pulled out that book. I just wanted to know, what had my dad seen in a book called The History of the Idea of Progress?
And so what are we... You're incorporating some humor into this show, of course, to help the hour go by. And just some of the juxtapositions are humorous in themselves. I mean, what happened in the election in 2016, and is that a part of our evolution or not?
Yeah, I mean, that has to be one of the most funny things that in recent years, right, that election.
But you ask if it's a part of a larger scheme of things.
Because we'd like to say, as I say in the show, is this just a temporary setback in some big curve of progress? Or I credit Trump. I thank him for putting the question in front of us. Is something deeper turning out there? And I think most of us try to keep that question away, keep it at bay, and say, this is kind of one of those things that happens in a cycle, but really we're heading on the upside here. Progress can't be stopped. Sure, they fight back. Sure, things take a little bit of settle, and then they move forward.
Sure, we discovered the human genome. Sure, we kill each other over borders.
You look at the longer cycles of history in all cultures. Nothing goes on forever. You look at evolution. No species survives forever. You got to ask yourself.
Aztecs, Mayans, you name it. It makes me think that we have been visited by, you know, extraterrestrials, and they're just waiting. These people still don't speak a common language. They're killing each other. They have people there, their fellow species that are going to bed hungry at night, that don't have homes. They're like, let's give them another millennia or two.
Yeah. There's other humor in the piece, and Neanderthals are inherently funny, as we all know. There's a stereotype of a Neanderthal as hunched over and hairy. It's not true. I think this is something I found in my research, the first Neanderthal fossil skeleton that was found in the Neander Valley of Germany in the 19th century was hunched over, and it wasn't till that was set in everyone's minds that people discovered that by chance was an old man with an arthritic spine. And since then, they found no hunched over Neanderthals.
Fascinating.
Makes better theater, though,
Of course. And so you perform as both Neanderthal and Homo sapiens.
It's my debut as a Neanderthal. It is.
We should mention that the Marsh Discovery series includes shows by emerging up-and-coming talent, established Marsh All-Star performers experimenting with a unique story or concept, as well as people from all walks of life who have developed powerful stories at the Marsh. They're not workshop runs, but rather they represent a culmination of some dedicated and lengthy creative processes. And this was developed with the great Charlie Varon, a frequent guest in Brilliant Mind, and directed by Kenny Young. Tell us about the development process of this work.
It was quite a loop through many things. I've known Charlie a long time, well before I started performing 20 years ago. It began really with a look at gentrification, and I thought, well, how boring. Everyone talks about gentrification. That's not theater. That's a lecture. And I came upon a news release as I was beginning the piece that the Neanderthal genome had been decoded, and it just popped in my head. There is the first gentrification. I started working on that with Charlie, and I started developing that character, started looking at the relationship, the conflict between Neanderthals and humans. And it became a much bigger piece after that, especially after Trump was elected, when these other questions about progress came to the fore. But this all started before that election.
Learn about all of the big questions through Paul Sussman's one-man show, The Wrong Kind of Pessimism, at the Marsh, 5 p.m. on Saturdays through the 18th. Paul, we're going to go out with Tracy Chapman singing The Times They Are A-Changing.
Thank you, David.
Evolution. We're all a part of it.
And admit that the waters around you have grown. Accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are changing. Come writers and critics, prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. And the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are changing.
The times they are a-changing and will continue to change over these next several millennia for however long you're around. Paul Sussman's show, more about that at themarsh.org. A very good afternoon to you once again. I'm David LaTulipe, and you're listening to Open Air here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. A number of wonderful performances are heading your way over these next several days, including former morning announcer Joe Burke, who's performing with the Yerba Buena Orchestra this Sunday, May 5th, at the Art House on Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley. Great music by a bunch of great musicians, including some original compositions by Joe. The Berkeley Symphony performs tonight. Georges Bizet's Carmen Suite No. 1, Thomas Addis's Powder Her Face, dances from that opera. Anna Klein's The Midnight Hour, as well as what we're hearing in the background, the Rosenkavalier Suite of Richard Strauss. Kristen Reif is the guest conductor with dancers from ODC Dance. That's tonight at 8 in Berkeley, and a reminder that we begin broadcasts of the entire Berkeley Symphony season this coming Monday, and for all the Mondays at 9 p.m., with yours truly as host. We'll hear the opening of the season back in October with Ming Luke as guest conductor and Benjamin Beilman violin. On the program this Monday's broadcast, Shostakovich's Festive Overture, Jennifer Higdon's Violin Concerto, Anna Klein's Night Fairy, and Maurice Ravel's La Valse. San Francisco Symphony tonight, Friday, and Saturday at 8 has Marek Janowski as guest conductor, with James Ennis as violin soloist for Brooks' Violin Concerto No. 1, Mendelssohn's Ruy Blas Overture, as well as a couple of works by Wagner, Janowski's specialty, the Overture and Venusberg music from Tannhäuser, and the Prelude and Liebestod from Tristan und Isolde. SFSymphony.org for more information there. Thanks for tuning in. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. Send me an email to tell me more and what you thought about today's show or others. David@kalw.org. Once again, you can hear this amazing music of Richard Strauss tonight at 8 as part of the Berkeley Symphony's performances.